I'm going to do an organizational thing or two. I'm going to turn my phone on so I can keep up with the time. The mind can only absorb what the seat can endure. So that way I won't keep you guys from doing things that are comfortable. This is the parent group, right? Mostly parents, kids at home, everybody from Rugrats to teenagers, or just teenagers, or Rugrats, okay. I've got an inbound grandchild, and I'm going to call it the Minion. So that's what, you know, I'm in Minion phase right now. One of the things that I've been involved in with churches is the idea of what do we do with the youth program? Why are kids involved in a youth program? When I made my step out of full-time church ministry into private practice, I thought, well, you know, if I'm not going to be in that club anymore, they're going to call me a youth minister, some of my experiences may go away. And so I decided to do some essays about youth ministry. And a large part of what I was writing about came from a book I'd read called Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World. A guy named Stephen Glenn and Jane Nelson did the study. And so I wrote Dr. Glenn and said, hey, I've been kind of using your book for years to pattern my youth ministry. And I want to know, can I use some of your research, some of your materials, some of the things you've talked about, as long as I give you credit? And Dr. Glenn was super, super gracious and gave me permission to use some of that. And so I started writing about and even talking to churches about raising spiritually self-reliant young people. And what I mean by spiritual self-reliance is, once they leave us, will they make biblically based decisions? Will they use a problem-solving model that's based on New Testament rather than the latest fad, what the media says, what the latest school trend is? Or will they actually be people who make decisions on spiritual things? And so I started trying to look at, in our youth ministry, what are we doing to raise spiritually self-reliant children? And so that's kind of what I wanted to talk about as we talk about integrating some of those ideas into family ministry. If I say something that you don't get or you need some clarification on, it'd be all right with me for you to make comments or ask questions. I tend to be a lecturer in this type setting. So, you know, if I just start rolling and you need to jerk those reins, it's okay with me. It won't be bad faux pas or anything. When you think about the idea of raising children in church, we typically have used the what I call the traditional parenting verses. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. I used to use passages out of the Proverbs when I was at summer camp. Beat him with a rod, he will not die. just letting kids know what page they were on, that kind of stuff. But I like to use a non-traditional verse when I talk about youth ministry. If you want to look at it, that's the verse from 1 Thessalonians 2. Now, Paul is talking not about parenting, but he's talking about his behavior as he was involved with the church at Thessalonica. And notice what he says here. He says, you are witnesses in God also, how devoutly, justly, and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe. And you know how we exhorted, comforted, and charged every one of you as a father does his own children. Paul says, when we were in your presence, when we were ministering to you, we functioned in a parental method. We treated you in a fatherly manner. We treated you like a father does his own children. And if you look at that in a different translation, the New Century Version says, you notice that we lived in a holy, honest way without fault. You know that we treated each of you as a father treats his children. We encouraged, we urged, and we insisted that you live these lives for God. And then I think the Contemporary English Version says, we begged, we encouraged, and we urged each of you. So when I start talking about parenting and dealing with the church, I use this as my model. I talk about it, encourage, comfort, and urge. Last night we talked about attention, belonging, and support. Well, when I'm dealing with young people and you come across my radar in my youth ministry or in my counseling practice or come through one of our adventure programs, the three things we want to do is encourage, comfort, and urge. Now, before we get to that, you think about the parental functions. There are basically three things to be as a leader of children, and then there are three things to do. The parents are to be devout. And looking at those different translations, you end up with the words pure, you end up with the words holy. Also, parents are to be just, sometimes known as fair or blameless, and then innocent and without fault. Basically, what it's saying is that when we start interacting with young people, that we've got to be consistent. We've got to be people who not only talk the talk, but walk the walk. So when we start talking about raising spiritually self-reliant young people, these are the things that as parents, we've got to kind of have our act together. If you notice this slide, are you familiar with the term at-risk behavior? This means yes. This means no. At-risk behavior is if a child is in school and they have at-risk behavior, they're not going to graduate. They're going to change their peer groups. They're going to use drugs. They're going to not finish college. It's any kind of thing that says these children aren't going to flourish. Well, if you use the term spiritually at-risk behavior, there's a predictor of your children having spiritually at-risk behavior. And it's basically this question. Do your parents profess things in public that they do not practice in private? I sit down with a young person, sit down with them at any age, after about age 10, and say, hey, your mom and dad go to church, you go to church with them, and do they say stuff in public that they don't really do at home? And if a child answers me that in the affirmative, it is a 95% predictor that they're going to fail to thrive spiritually. That's pretty sobering. And the reason that's important is because children don't do mixed messages well. People make fun of me. This is my symbol for cognitive dissonance. Okay, children can handle this, and children can handle this. And children don't do this very well. Okay, it's why teenage boys don't understand teenage girls, because teenage girls talk. That's how they communicate, by the way. Okay, it's the idea, and I've seen students come through many, many years of programs where their parents said, we're not interested in what goes on at that church. We don't necessarily like that youth minister. You can go down there and do anything you want to, but we're not going. And I've seen a lot of kids thrive because they get surrogate spiritual parents. And I've seen other kids say, mom and dad say, come go with us and we will grow together. And I've seen kids do phenomenally well. When I see kids fall off the radar and derail off the tracks, it's when they've got this going on. That you come to worship and then you talk about the elders and the ministers and what that lady had on, and can you believe her, how bad her kid behaves. And so when you profess things in public that you do not practice in private, you get the at-risk behavior. One of the things that came out of that is this EPAC study. The EPAC study was done by Stephen Glenn, the author of this book. And basically what it did is it gives a test where you talk about the perception of how you were parented. And it basically has four quadrants, really. You have permissiveness, strictness, hostility, and love. And then if you quad those out, you've got these quadrants, and you talk to children and say, tell me what it was like to grow up in your home. And they take this test, and after they take this test, they say, hey, when we grew up, mom and dad parented us, and you really have hostile permissiveness, permissiveness with love, love with strictness, and hostility with strictness. And so when a child says, hey, I had a certain amount of autonomy and had a certain amount of control given to me by my home, it ends up that sometimes you have parents who parented their kids with hostile autonomy. They're allowed to do anything they want to do as long as they don't bother the parents. I don't care where you go, I don't care what you do, just don't wake me up. I don't care what you're doing in your room, I'm watching football. And so they have this idea that you're free to do what you want to, but the freedom comes from a sense of that mom and dad are kind of hostile or antagonistic. Everybody get that? Then you have parents who have hostile control. Kind of the old tongue-in-cheek. What do you say to a kid with two black eyes? Nothing. You done told him twice, you know. He said, I'm the boss, and I'm going to pound you, and you're going to be afraid of me. You know, the old line, you know I can make another one just like you. And so it's that I control you, but it's out of that autocratic, dictatorial, almost intimidating kind of stuff. Then you have folks who said we have excessive autonomy. You know, I love you so much, I don't want to hurt your feelings. I love you so much, I just don't want you to ever be disappointed. This is when your hippies had kids. We just want you to be happy. Then you have parents who parented with this excessive control. Oh, you're not pitching? I'll go down there and talk to that coach right now. You're going to be the pitcher on that team. Let me write your Leadership Training for Christ lesson for you. Let me make sure I give you the ability to pass the Bible ball. And it's almost the idea that we love them so much we can't let them make mistakes. And so their homework becomes our homework. Their responsibilities become our responsibilities. We even decide, oh, that kid treated you badly. He's not your good friend. I'll go tell his mother about that. And it's that over-parenting, over-control. This is the helicopter parent flying a Black Hawk, okay? Not just helicopter, but it's an armed helicopter. Well, when you do this survey and you talk to parents and you talk to kids, it's interesting that the first time they did this survey, they did it on a prison population. And so they really, you know, Stephen Glenn, when he did his study on capable people, so he was really finding it hard to find capable people. So they studied a prison population. And he said, when we started talking to these guys, we began to be able to think we can make predictions. That if somebody says, hey, my parents parented this way, could we predict something they were involved in? If we ended up with a kid who said, hey, my parents parented down in here, could we begin to predict what they... And they began to be able to predict, hey, these are the people who use marijuana, these are the people who use coke, these are the people who use hallucinogens, these are the people who join cults, these are the people who are promiscuous. And some of their predicted rates were as good as 68% based simply on how a child perceived their parents parented them. I'll share a little bit of that with you. That little sweet spot right here, that's a real important thing in our chart, and just kind of remember that. Look at the relationship between permissiveness and control with love and the absence of hostility. That's going to be kind of important. When they started talking about their predictability and stuff, they said if somebody said, hey, our parents parented this way, they could predict with about 68% accuracy that those kids would smoke marijuana. I told you that's where the hippies had babies, right? Right there, that, you know, we care what you do, just want you to be relaxed and then have a good time. Over here, you had the folks that would use hallucinogens and inhalants, and that was the parents who said, yeah, we just don't care much about you, just go have fun. Our parents didn't interact with us very much, so just go on, don't bother me. Parents who hostile with strictness or strictness hostility, they predicted that those kids would use heroin. And you get down here where these kids are over control, that hyper, we're going to do all the stuff for you. Those are the kids who use alcohol, coke, and sedatives. And by the way, this is your population of kids who kill themselves because they've got to be number one, they've got to be perfect, they've got to make all A's, they've got to be all Americans. And at some point, the pressure to be is just too much, and they exit the planet. Okay, those kids grow up with the idea that in my world, if this wall is ideal and that wall is unacceptable, if I'm in the room, I'm a happy little ball guy. But those kids grow up being taught that the separation between ideal and unacceptable is about razor thin. If I'm not the best, I'm the worst. If I didn't do it all, I didn't do any. If I can't accomplish that, I can't accomplish anything. If mom doesn't approve of me, I'll never be approved of. Those are the kids who develop some real interesting psychological issues. Now, kids are prone to all or nothing thinking anyway because they're teenagers. I mean, that's the way they have that emotional dysregulation. But if our parenting style falls into that love with the strictness, it really creates some difficulties for them to be balanced and healthy people. And remember that sweet spot I warned you about right here? The balance between permissiveness, strictness, and love? In that study, people who said, hey, my parents parented with that right there, there was no incidences of behavioral problems. Bring them up in the nurture, love, and admonition, some permissiveness, some responsibility with strictness, that I'm going to make you accountable for your own behaviors. Now, that's not out of the New Testament. That's from a guy who's a pagan psychologist and did this study with the prison population. And so I think it's very interesting that when we begin to talk about raising spiritually self-reliant children, the first place we need to look at is us. Are we doing our jobs with being the kind of things that we're supposed to be? If you look at the three parental functions, we're supposed to encourage, we're supposed to comfort, and we're supposed to urge. And kind of depending on where you're at, the encouraging part is basically how we model and involve our kids in all kind of varieties of things. The comforting part is what I do when I talk about crisis intervention. And then the urging part is where I talk a lot about discipline. And I don't know, is this one of those things where, hey, get to the discipline part first? Or when can we spank them? I think that's what everybody wants to know. Are you okay if we just kind of go through this? I spend too much time on one point. You'll get me. Okay. If this is a what we call an inverse proportionate diagram, what happens is that if you look at dependence and you look at independence, if you'll notice that when dependence is very, very great, independence is very, very small. When dependence goes way, way down, independence goes way, way up. That's why it's an inverse proportionate diagram. Everybody got that? Okay, so when a child is born, all the way through the adult, that's a function of time. That's a linear timeline. When you are born, you are 100% dependent. You can't do anything without your parents. You can't roll over. You don't control what goes in. You don't control when it comes out. If you're a little girl, you wear a head tourniquet with a flower on it that's bigger than your whole brain, because mom and dad want to see you with a ribbon in your hair. And so, you know, you've got this garter on your head. And if they had fine motor control, they'd take them off, but they can't. And so there they are. They are 100% dependent, and they have 0% independence. They don't get to choose what they wear, where they go, what they eat. They're just there. If they turn over, you use an egg flipper. Otherwise, they're just there. As they get older, as they grow older, their dependence level should reduce and their independence level should increase, so that at some point we're taking a dirt nap and our kids are independent. They don't have to rely on us for what they do, where they go, what they eat, and they're able to make good adult choices. Everybody clear? Now, the cool thing about this is there's a middle part of this chart. And let's clean it up and just stick that middle in there. That's a teenager. This section right here, you're as much adult as you are a child. You have all the information that you've ever had. You're as old as you've ever been, and you feel like you're an adult, but at the same time, you're a child. That's why a child will go, I want my own car, I want my own money, and I want my own job so I can buy video games. And you've got to have that message there. A 16-year-old boy is as old as he's ever been. Ask a 16-year-old, how old are you? He'll go, I'm 16. How many times have you been 16? One. Okay, they usually get it right. And a 16-year-old boy is as big as he's ever been. He's getting those muscles in. He's getting all that stuff. He's got the ability to drive. He's got his first little car. He's got his first little girl. And he thinks he's at the top of his game. And if you're 16... and it's the first time you've been 16, yeah, you pretty much are this monstrous animal at your school. You're a junior, or oh my, a senior. Well, I've got a French fry underneath the seat of my truck at 16. It's not that big a deal with me anymore. But they don't realize it. So when they begin to talk with you and interact with you as you have a teenager, you know, they're in the closest they've ever been to being an adult, but they're still very, very dependent and very, very independent. That's what makes teenagers so fun to work with. That's what makes them so just the best population in the world. I'd rather spend my time with teenagers than anybody else. The teenage brain is a marvelous and scary thing. If you go outside on a very, very clear night and look up in the sky, you can observe right at a billion stars. Maybe, I think it's 3 billion stars that you can see. I've never counted. Your brain has that many neurological pathways in it. This is the most complicated thing in the known universe, is the human brain. And you have about 300 billion dendrites, or neurological pathways. A teenager has three times that many. Their brain is developing at an astronomical rate. Their brain says, hey, let's make some pathways. Let's connect to some stuff. What do we want to connect to? Let's connect to everything. And it blows up. The only time a child's brain grows that much in their life is when they're two. A teenager is a two-year-old that can drive. Okay, that's what makes them super cool stuff. And that's what makes them super challenging. I argue that Abraham's son Isaac was not a teenager when God asked him to sacrifice him. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been a very big act of faith. Kill that kid? No problem. Okay, so they've got this, and that brain is developing. You know, there's not a lot of very substantial rock music being written by anybody in their 30s. The teenagers are those people. Look at the stuff that's happening on YouTube and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and the creative stuff that comes out of those 16 to 25-year-olds. Very, very creative stuff. And what happens in the teenage brain, your prefrontal cortex and your limbic system for the first time in your life can talk to each other. So the first time in the world, their thinking and their feeling brain send messages back and forth. That's why a teenager can think and upset themselves. That's why you can have a teenage girl go, hi, walk into a room and come out, Haiti is devastated. I need to borrow money and go clean up Haiti. Have you looked at your room and you're worried about Haiti? You know, it's just one of those weird kind of things. We call it emotional dysregulation. But it's because they're playing with the idea of an adult and they're still a child. Our job as parents and as churches is to move them from being spiritually dependent to being spiritually independent, helping them grow to the place where when they move away or we're no longer under their, or they're no longer under our influence, that they can strive and do well. And that's kind of the goal of youth ministry. So what is the deal? The number one thing that we want to do is encourage. It comes from a really interesting Greek word. Can be translated to beg, to plead. Sometimes it's the word exhort. It's basically from a Greek word that says to call to one side for aid. Now, if you talk about Stephen Glenn and the stuff that he wrote about, Glenn talks about the significant seven. And he says that if you look at a person who is capable, they have seven things in their lives. If you look at a person who is not capable, they are missing some or all of the significant seven. There are basically three perceptions and four skills. Of the three perceptions, this fulfills two of them. Perception number one is I am capable, and perception number two is I am significant. When we teach our children, we encourage our children to come to our side and help. What that basically means is that the church's function is not to provide things for the young people, but to let the young people be involved in the things the church is involved in. Does that make sense? We're raising a generation of consumers. We're raising a generation of people who church shop for who's got the best program, who's got the most activities, who's got the most fun, who takes the best trips, who does the most exotic stuff. And really what we should be teaching them to do is, you've got some ownership here, and we want you involved in the work here. In the latter part of Acts, Paul is on a boat going to Rome. The boat is shipwrecked. They end up floating on some debris. They end up on the island of Malta. And the natives of Malta build a fire big enough to warm about 317 people, maybe, and some change. And Paul brings a bundle of sticks to that fire. Now, we always teach this lesson in VBS because it makes this great VBS skit, because you've got this pile of sticks and a snake comes out and bites Paul on the arm. And you get the overenthusiastic deacon who fights the rubber snake on stage, and it makes Vacation Bible School gold. Okay? But that's not the point of that story. Why is Paul putting sticks on a fire he didn't build? Because he can. Because he likes the warmth. He likes the light. He's been floating in the water for a couple of hours, and it's raining on the island of Malta. And there's a fire that he's getting some benefit from, and he wants to continue getting that benefit, so he brings some sticks to it. When we teach our young people that you didn't start this fire, But if you want it to be here when you're an adult, if you want it to be here when you have kids, you've got a contribution to make to this. And you teach them, number one, you're capable. There are some things you can do for the church. There's some things you can do at the church. And I'm not talking about traditional leadership roles, although I think it's very important for young men to lead singing and lead prayers and wait on the Lord's table, and the young ladies do girls' devotionals, and the young ladies do girls' Bible classes and stuff. But let me please caution you that performing task does not equal spirituality. Okay? I don't want to be irreverent. I can teach a monkey to hand out communion trays. You give me a strong enough battery and a shock collar, and he'll turn left every time he's supposed to turn left. But just because he can perform that doesn't make him spiritual. A kid can get up and read a script. A kid can get up and say a prayer. A kid can get up and announce song and wave his hands. That doesn't make them spiritual. What I'm talking about teaching children that they are capable is teaching them that they have the ability to contribute to the work of the church. They have the ability to participate in the things that we do, whether it's benevolence or mission trips or that kind of stuff. And if we don't expect our children to be involved in the day-to-day operations of what we do here, then they don't have any buy-in. They don't have any ownership. They don't have any sweat equity. And so we teach our kids that I'm capable. And you do that at home too, by the way. Contrary to Harry Potter, there's no such thing as a house elf. Everything that happens in a home gets done by a person. Every piece of clothing that is folded, every laundry item that is washed, every blade of grass that's cut, every meal that's served, a human was involved in that. And if your children aren't doing things to learn to take care of the home, at least policing their own laundry, or at least keeping their own room clean, or being responsible for some basic chores, they're going to learn that I'm just a victim. I can't do that, and nobody did it for me, so I'll wait till it's done for me. You ever met anybody who had learned helplessness? We have a lot of learned helplessness in the church. I'm not growing spiritually, it's because I don't like the preacher. I'm not edifying God because our singing is those old songs and they're slow. I'm not able to edify God because people won't stand up and do holy aerobics. Well, your relationship with God is about you and God. And you're capable of developing that on a personal level in a crowd and by yourself in your own private meditations. And if we don't teach them that capabilities, they'll never learn, first of all, that they're capable, and number two, they'll never learn that they're significant. That I've got a contribution to make to this church, and if I don't go and I don't do and I don't participate and I'm not active, it doesn't get done as well. And so as parents, we're encouraging our children to be a part of those kind of things. Now, how do you teach people not to be afraid? How do you encourage people? Number one treatment for anxiety is if I've got a client who's phobic, we do systematic desensitization, and he learns to be not phobic about the things that he's scared of. If you have panic attacks in a large room, you got to start spending some time in large rooms. If you have panic attacks about flying, you have to talk about flying. You have to watch films on flying. You have to visualize yourself flying, but at some point, you got to get in a plane and fly. Well, we encourage our young people that even though something may be uncomfortable for you, it may be something that's outside of your like zone. If you're going to learn to be capable and significant, you've got to participate with us in it in order to do it. George Barna did a study on retention of church kids, and the old statistic used to be we lost like 75% of our kids between the ages of 13 and 23. The follow-up of that years later was 80% of the 75% that fell away came back to the church in their late 20s if they had one thing in common. If they were active as frequently as once a month in something that the church did outside of worship. If they came up here, mom and dad, and put cards in the back of the pews. If they came up here, mom and dad, and prepared communion trays. If they went with dad to wash the van. If they went with dad, who's a deacon, and delivered fruit baskets. If the kids had ownership and bought into, hey, I've got a job I do at this church, they were capable and significant. When I was at Maysville Church of Christ as their youth minister, one of the interesting things we did is we didn't hire a professional janitorial staff to clean our building. We had groups of people who cleaned the building every month. And the teenage youth group had a month where they cleaned the building. And so you find this little 13-year-old pledging the pews, and you say, because we're not paying somebody to do this and you're doing it, we're able to put two more missionaries in the field for that price. Thank you for supporting the gospel by polishing a pew or cleaning the windows or doing something like that. We did an awful lot of things for ourselves so that we could spend the money on something else and had the kids learning that my contribution to saving the lights or cleaning the van or polishing the pews or vacuuming the classroom was a direct contribution to saving the church money and doing something. So we're encouraging young people to participate with us and helping them not to be afraid to be people of faith. Any questions on this phase? Everybody good? Is this practical enough or is it too theoretical? So I get used to being theoretical sometimes. The next thing we do is comfort. Comfort is the idea of literally to give counsel or to advise. This is the crisis intervention phase. This is if you have teenage girls. Because everything's a crisis. You know, the world is falling apart. What we do with this is basically to stimulate to the discharge of the ordinary duties of life. We're going to help people overcome some things where they feel discouraged or they want to quit or they want to stop. And this is how we deal with the crisis in kids. Basically, sometimes it's about just demonstrating understanding to our kids, and sometimes it's about crisis intervention. Sometimes when your kids are in crisis, they really don't need any answers. They just need what John Gottman calls attunement. If you've never read anything on emotion coaching or raising emotionally intelligent kids, I highly recommend that. We tend to be sometimes as Christians emotion dismissing or emotion disapproving. Well, you're a Christian, you can't feel that way. Oh, just decide to be happy. Take off that frat and put it. And emotions aren't like clothes. They're real, they're authentic, they're legitimate. The thing that I have to teach teenagers is your emotions are not instructions, but are information. You understand the difference between instruction and information. Yeah, I'm on a road trip with my wife. We stop at a gas station. I go in. I stay 45 minutes, come out. She says, what's going on? I said, well, they had a sign that said clean restrooms. So I had to find a mop and some rubber gloves, and I took care of business. Well, you know the difference between emotion versus information versus instruction. Teenagers need to learn your emotions are valid and healthy. They don't tell you to do anything. They tell you something. Now, the something that they tell you can lead to telling you to do something, but a lot of times we need to understand what they're feeling at the time. Are you hurt? Are you scared? Are you angry? And a lot of times, it's simply letting the teenager know that I view the world through the same lens you view it. I don't necessarily validate it. I don't necessarily think it's rational, but I do get your viewpoint of it. That make sense? Okay. With the crisis intervention, I'll give you kind of a primer on cognitive behavioral therapy, which is not as bad as it sounds. But for everything that happens in life, especially in the life of a teenager, for every event, and it doesn't matter what it is, football, school, dating, not dating, not football, not school, video game broke, dog ran away, got a hamster, whatever. For every event that happens in life, you get a byproduct, and that byproduct is emotion. Now, where do your emotions come from? Where do you get the ability to emote? My wife said, that's not a word. It's a word. Trust me. Where do you get the ability to emote? Where does it come from? God. The software package was installed at the factory. So your emotions are there. You came wired for them. Therefore, your emotions are all valid. There's nothing that you have the capability of feeling that is wrong for you to feel. Because that is a source of information. It tells you something. When you use your emotions properly, they lead you to balance and to harmony. That's what your emotions do. They tell you something. The thing that they tell you can lead you to make decisions. And when you make proper decisions, you end up being a balanced and harmonious person. Godly sorrow works repentance that leads to salvation, not to be regretted. What's the function of guilt? It makes me behave differently. Now, if guilt causes you not to change your behavior, but just causes you to isolate or causes you to self-destruct, then guilt's not doing what it's supposed to do. Look at the discussion between Peter and Judas. And it really didn't take place, but we're pretending it did. On the night that Jesus was arrested, one of the 12 apostles admitted knowing him. One out of 12. Who was it? That would be Judas. So now let's have that conversation between Peter and Judas. I can't believe you told those guys you knew Jesus. I can't believe you told those guys you didn't. Yet one guy self-destructs, one guy weeps, bitterly repents, and does the first gospel sermon in Acts. Peter's repentance led him back to balance and harmony. Judas's idea led him to destruction or dysfunction. So when I start dealing with a young person, I even start dealing with an adult at my practice, and there's emotions. I don't really get wrapped up in the emotional content until I figure out where the emotions are going. If somebody's emotions are leading you to balance and harmony, if something has gone wrong in your life, you lost your job, and as you came home early from work, you ran over your dog, and you're not a little bit upset about that, you're psychotic. There are some things in life that will depress you, and depression has a path that it follows, and once you deal with those emotions, you end up balanced. Be angry and do not sin. Don't let the sun go down upon your wrath. Nothing wrong with being angry as long as anger doesn't drive the bus, as long as anger doesn't make me punch holes in the wall or yell and scream or whatever, doesn't make me accusatory towards you. It's okay to be angry about injustice and unfairness and different things as long as that anger produces something healthy later on. If I hold my anger in, and so many times we teach young people to control your temper, and that what they hear is be angry and hold it in. And so their picture of controlling their temper is this. You know, controlling your temper is learning that that anger has a path it needs to follow. And anger is energy, by the way. And energy follows the path of least resistance. With girls, it comes out here and here. With boys, it comes out here and here. But you learn not to let the anger drive the bus, and then you get some healthy results. It's okay to tell me things are unfair. It's okay to tell, but there's a proper way to talk to me, and there's an improper way to talk to me. It's not that you can't be angry, it's you've got to express the anger in a different way. So when I'm talking to somebody and there's an event, and I don't care what it is, and that event produces emotions, if the emotions are doing this, that's a natural healthy process. It's going to work out. When I start seeing destruction and dysfunction or even sometimes distress, I'm going to start doing some work. Because when I see emotions that produce destruction and dysfunction, then what's missing here is this little filter. And all your events are filtered through this little thing that we call perception. What you perceive has more effect on what you see than what you see has on what you perceive. I'll say it one more time for the Tennessee fans. What you perceive has more power over what you see than what you see has on what you perceive. No one who doesn't believe in Bigfoot has ever seen him. Right? I'm in the woods and I see something large and hairy. It's a guy in a ghillie suit. It's a bear. It's a gorilla. It's my wife's mother. But it's not Bigfoot. Okay? But if I believe in Bigfoot and I see something large and hairy, it could be a bear, but I think it's a Bigfoot. Because my perception causes that. Can you remember being in junior high and thinking a girl or a boy liked you? And you walk into the cafeteria and she looks at you and she smiles and she says something to her friends and they all laugh. You go, oh yeah, I got it. Or you walk into the same cafeteria, it's the same girl, and your perception is she doesn't like you. And she looks at you and smiles and turns to her friends and says, oh, they're making fun of me again. You don't know the content of that conversation, but your perception causes that to happen. See, our perceptions cause us to assign meanings to things. And the meanings we assign to things can be valid, or the meanings we assign can be invalid based on our perceptions. You remember the story of Joseph? Joseph's dad gives him a richly ornamented robe, sometimes translated as a coat of many colors, sometimes translated as a coat with sleeves. What does that mean when he gets this coat? Why does he have a coat and the other boys don't? What does that mean? Dad loves me more. It really is a symbol that he's going to get the stuff. This is the heir apparent. He's not the oldest son, but he's the oldest son from my favorite wife. Now, how does Joseph handle this newfound power? He's kind of like a brat, isn't he? He comes up to his brothers. Hey, I had a dream. I had stuff. Y'all had stuff. Your stuff bowed down to my stuff. I'm getting the stuff. Later, losers, you know. And he doesn't do very good with this. In fact, he starts ratting out his brothers. They're not doing what they're supposed to do. He tells Dad on them. And so later, Dad uses him as a spy. His brothers are out here in the wilderness. Joseph doesn't have to work out with those guys. Dad says, hey, I want you to go check on them. Joseph gets lost. If your dad's a sheep herder and you get lost, how much sheep herding you think you've done? Not a whole lot. So now he's lost, finally finds his brothers, and as he comes over the hill, what do his brothers say? Here comes that dreamer. That whole dream thing he told them, that was a bad move. So now he's out here in the wilderness by himself with his brothers, whom he's not treated very well, and his brothers invent the game Survivor. And they vote Joseph off the island, okay? And they sell him. Now, I'm not sure if you've ever thought about that, but, you know, you're just rocking along, having a good day, and you sell a sibling. How do you manage that at supper? You go home for supper and say, hey, we sold one of your kids. I mean, what do you do with it? So what do they tell their dad? Remember what they tell their dad? Killed by a beast? They don't tell him anything. They take a coat, they dip it in goat's blood, and they say, you recognize this? And Dad says, the bloody coat, not being British there, the bloody coat means my son is dead. It means he's been torn by a wild animal, and it means I'll go to my grave mourning. Is that what that bloody coat means? Is Joseph dead? No. Was he torn by an animal? How do you tear a kid out of his coat and not tear his coat? That's straight up ninja quality line stuff there, boys and girls. You know, and just snatched him right out of his jacket. And then he says, I'll go to my grave mourning. In Alabama, that translates as I ain't never going to be happy again. And look how fragile he is. Years later, they end up in Egypt. And after they end up in Egypt, he asks his brothers, you got another brother? I really think he's asking about himself. Because you got to look at Joseph's perception. I disappeared, and nobody's come looking for me. My dad, who gave me the coat, hasn't even looked for me. He doesn't know they told him he was dead. For all he knows, they went back and said, hey, your son kind of offended us. We sold him. He doesn't know what happened. So he's lived in Egypt this long, and nobody cares. So he asked his brothers, you got another brother? I think he's thinking about when they fess up and tell my story. And they go, yeah, we got two. One's no more, and one's a young boy. He goes, I've got a brother. A real brother, a brother from my mother. Bring him here. Now, I think Joseph's plan, and I'm chasing a rabbit here. Look at how squirrely Joseph behaves. He plants a cup in Benjamin's sack. And when they get halfway home, what's the message? His servant finds him and says, hey, you stole a cup. They go, no, we ain't stole nothing. Yeah, you stole a cup. We promise you there's not a cup here. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm gonna search you. I'll tell you what, we're so innocent, if you find a cup, that guy can be your slave forever. And that's what the servant says. He said, I won't kill him, he'll be my slave forever. Well, why has Benjamin got this cup planted on him? So Joseph can adopt him. The servant says, hey, this kid's guilty. His brothers, the pit thrower enters, will let this kid go. He brings his brother back home and says, hey, look, you're not really in trouble. I'm your real brother. Those bunch of losers left me in a pit to die, and they hung you out to dry because you had this cup in the sack. See what rascals they are? Welcome to the riches of Egypt. Those guys are going to starve to death because they can't grow grain. I'm your real brother. I think that's Joseph's plan. Now, what happens is when his brother comes back and says, you can't keep this kid. Our dad is fragile. If that boy doesn't show up back home, that old man will die. Take me. I'll go to prison forever. And Joseph sees that these guys have changed. It breaks his heart to the point he runs everybody out of the room and weeps so loudly the message gets back to Pharaoh, hey, Joseph's crying. That kind of explains Joseph's behavior to me. But look at the perception of the old man. My son's dead. My son's torn by a lion. And if something happens to Benjamin, I'll fall apart. He's let this one dysfunctional interpretation of these events color his entire life. If the meanings we assign to things are valid, we end up with valid emotions that lead us to balance and harmony. If the meanings we assign to things are invalid, then we end up with invalid emotions that lead us to destruction and dysfunction. So when your kids get into crisis, when something happens and your child comes home and they're all upset, the first thing we need to ask is, what happened? Tell me about it. Who did what? Who didn't do what? Who said what? Whatever. And then the next thing you ask is, what does this mean to you? And then when you find out what it means to them, you can start working with crisis intervention with your child. Remember, your kids are all or nothing thinkers. They believe they are responsible for things that they cannot control, and they sometimes feel a great sense of entitlement because of their fairness concept. If I'm a good kid, you'll be a good kid. If I'm honest, you'll be honest. If I trust you, you should be trusted. And that's really not the way the world works, is it? But our kids are vulnerable to that kind of stuff. So when your young people go into crisis, the first thing I'm going to find out is what happened. The second thing I'm going to find out is what does it mean to you? And then very, very gently, I'm going to ask, hey, does this mean what you think it means? And sometimes when you start talking to a child, and tell me what you feel and tell me what you know. And when those two things overlap each other, we don't have a crisis anymore. My daughter is 4'10" and played Division I volleyball. Now, she's the only Division I volleyball player to ever come out of Madison County High School. She's not the only Division I volleyball player to ever walk on the court down there where they paid her to go to college. So I said, hey, you're big snuff here. You're walking in tall cotton in Madison County. But you get down there, they got girls that are lined up to take your spot. So calm down when you get down there. I said, but if you're down there at that Division I school and you serve a volleyball and the volleyball hits the net, one of those coaches is going to lose his mind and scream and yell and get red in the face and throw a clipboard. Another coach on that court is going to clap and cheer. Which coach is your friend? She said, say that again, Dad. I said, okay. You recognize the coach who loses his mind is her coach, because Division I volleyball players don't serve balls into the net. And the coach who claps and cheers coaches for the other team. And he's glad you messed up. Sometimes the people who love you the most yell at you the loudest. I'm not giving you permission to yell. I'm using it as an example, okay? But a lot of times kids will come home, the coach hates me. Why does the coach hate you? Well, he said, did you make his team? How many players does he have on that bat? Oh, he has 12 players, and you're one of the 12? How many kids tried out for that team? The last time my wife had volleyball tryouts at her middle school, had 75 girls try out. She got to pick 9. Now, one of those girls says, Miss Jones hates me. If you're one of the 9, Miss Jones does not hate you. She thinks you have some potential as a volleyball player. But you ask a child, hey, what happened? What does this mean to you? And gently compare what you feel versus what you know. Is that what that really means? Does that make sense? Crisis intervention with your kids? That works with little bitty guys all the way up to your college-age folks. It actually works pretty well with your spouses. You've got to be careful with the spouses going, does it mean what you think it means? That's sort of my job. They can throw stuff at me in my office. But, you know, you basically are trying to find out what's going on in their lives. And if you figure out what it means to a child and you demonstrate understanding, you really don't even have to fix it. You know, your seventh grade daughter comes home and she's heartbroken because she and a boy were going together. And they couldn't go places. They never went anywhere. And suddenly they're not going the places they didn't go. And her heart's broken. And she says, Dad, we're not going together anymore. And I take her in my lap and I can say, well, honey, statistically, you'll be in 8 major relationships before you're married. 60% of you will be engaged at least one time. So there's one down and about 14 to go. Does that help her at all? Does it? Or you put her in your lap and say, tell me about it. Are you mad at him or mad at yourself because you feel like you trusted him and he used you? Are you heartbroken? Are you hurt? Are you angry? Yeah, Dad. Sometimes that's all it takes, is letting them know you understand what it means to them, and you really don't even have to challenge that meaning sometimes. They just need to know that you care about how they feel. And you know how many kids will come into my office and say, my parents don't listen to me. They do all the talking and none of the listening. Very, very important to do some emotion coaching and get tuned into your kids. And then sometimes, you know, viewing the world from their perspective. I do this and it gets me in trouble. But, gentlemen, do you guys know how to back a trailer? How do you back a trailer? You go the opposite way. Now, that's counterintuitive, isn't it? This is left and that's right. What? When you learn to deal with your spouse, don't throw stuff. It's like backing a trailer. You have to see the world in opposite terms. You have to view the world from the perspective of the trailer in order to get it to cooperate. And sometimes in dealing with your spouse, you have to view the world the way they see it. In dealing with your young people, sometimes you have to adopt their worldview. You know, to you, getting on the junior high basketball team is not a significant thing. But if you're in junior high, it's fairly significant. If you're a fifth grade honor roll student, you didn't make the honor roll anymore, you realize what fifth grade honor roll means. Not a whole lot. But students don't always have that perspective. And sometimes it's just about adopting a worldview that says, I understand what your values are. I don't have to validate them, but I don't have to invalidate them either. I can just simply say, I know this hurts you because of this. And when you tune into your kids, you really don't have to solve a lot of problems as much as you just tune into them while they're hurting. Job's three friends came and sat on the ground with him for 7 days and didn't say a word. We call that the ministry of presence. Now, when our daughter was real little, she had nightmares about tigers. I think it goes back to the Disney movie with Shere Khan. There's something about a bad guy with a British accent that's just, you know, apparently overwhelming, and then you turn it into a tiger. And she'd wake up at night yelling about tigers, and I'd dash into the room, and no tigers. I come in the room armed sometimes, no tigers. You know, tell her, Lonnie Beth, there's no tigers in North Alabama. Rent the National Geographic film, no tigers in North Alabama. Videotape the room, there's no tigers. Dad, they're invisible tigers. So we obviously have this tiger issue at our house. Underneath our kitchen sink is this cabinet, and there's this yellow bottle of aerosol spray, P-L-E-D-G-E, spells tiger spray, smells like lemons. You go into a child's room with tiger spray, spray the curtains and spray in the bed and spray the closet, you ain't any tiger problems at all. It works on bad dreams and monsters. Amazing stuff. She gets to be about six and says, Dad, P-L-E-D-G-E does not spell tiger spray. And I go, well, it only works on tigers that aren't real. And sometimes for crisis intervention with your children, you have to deal occasionally with some invisible tigers. And there's nothing wrong with that. You don't ever want to enter a delusion with a person, but really what you're doing here is you're demonstrating understanding. John Gottman calls it attunement, but letting your child know, I know this hurts you, and I'm hurt because you're hurt. Not necessarily because it's that important, but because you're that important. Does that make sense? Spend a little more time on crisis intervention. Anybody got any questions or ready to move on? All good? All right, we'll jump right into urge. Urge is the idea of to charge, to motivate, or literally to train. This is where we get our word for discipline. Discipline is the idea of to put stress in a relationship so that the result is growth. That's my definition for discipline. All discipline is not punishment. All punishment is not discipline. Okay? You put stress in the relationship so the result is growth. So of your three perceptions, I'm capable, I'm significant. The third perception is I can influence what happens to me. And that's where we get into discipline. Basically, the idea of disciplining a child is letting them know that your choices have consequences, and a lot of times those consequences are logical consequences. 1 Kings chapter 6, and Adonijah declared, I will be king. because his father had never rebuked him, questioned him, or interfered with him, saying, "Why do you act as you do?" Your job as a parent is to intervene, question, and rebuke when your children don't behave properly. And that's about your standards at your house and the things that you do. Basically, I have kind of you call it a mantra or an axiom, I guess. All human behavior is reward motivated. I do what I do the way I do it because it gets me something I want. Now you think about that, and whatever it is, even people who are highly, highly dysfunctional sometimes have secondary gains. I've got a client who's got an obsessive compulsive condition. He has 125 documented rituals. But if he gets cured, he's not on disability anymore. And he's very difficult to treat. We get a few little things put to bed, but he always has a flare-up because that's his only source of income. And I'm not accusing him of malingering or being duplicitous, but I have some great suspicions about it. But I behave the way I behave because what I do gets me something that I want. Now, as you mature, your behavior gets you things that you value. But when we just live with what we want, that's instantaneous gratification. Okay? So all human behavior is reward motivated. I do what I do the way I do it because it gets me something I want. That's axiom one. Axiom two, when my behavior cost me more than it cost you, I will reevaluate my behavior. And that's the point of discipline. It's not punishment as much as putting stress on. I can't make you do your homework. I can't. I can't physically put a pencil in your hand and make you think and get the right answers. But I can make you want to do your homework. I can't make you clean your room. "Hey, Susie, clean your room." "I don't want to." Now, you know, modern parenting is more tolerant of that. When I was growing up, we'd have been in the emergency room if we said something like, but you know, we're a kinder, gentler parenting now. But you know, you say, "Hey, I need you to clean your room. I need you to pick up your toys." And there's a difference in a kid being a kid and a kid being defiant. Okay? But let's just take the room for example. "Hey, I need you to clean your room," and little Susie doesn't do it. You can stand there, yell and scream, pitch a fit, jump up and down, and stand there and make them pick up everything while they're being a hostile witness. You can do that. But you end up on the left side of our parenting chart. Or you simply say, "You understand what I've asked you to do?" And you walk away. Now, in my world, you can do either pay me now or pay me later, or you can do, "Ooh, I probably should have done that." Because you set a time. If it's not done by 6 o'clock, I'll go in there and clean it up, and everything on the floor goes away. "Hey, Mommy, where's Barbie?" "Where was Barbie supposed to be?" "In the closet." "Was she there?" "Nope. Barbie took a trip." You know, I mean, this is one of those things. Or it's simply, if you've got older kids, whatever it is, let it go. "Hey, Dad, the youth group's going to go eat pizza." "Well, when we go home and you clean your room, you can go out with them." "But, Dad, that'd take me an hour. I missed it." "You should probably do what I tell you to do when I tell you to do it." And you're consistent enough with that. They learn that when Mom and Dad says go, they go. And if Mom and Dad ask for it, if I don't do it now, it's going to bite me later. You can do all kind of cool stuff like that. Kids dragging their feet, not getting ready for school. Get you an egg timer, get you a stopwatch, turn it on, rock and roll. "Okay, I wanted to walk out of the house at 7 o'clock. We didn't walk out of the house till 7:15. Had to take you to school, and I was late for work. 15 minutes, and you can do a minute equals a minute, or a minute equals an hour, or a minute equals a day. You owe me this much time back in my life because you not doing what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it cost me. When my behavior costs me more than it costs you, I'll change your behavior." Okay? I teach a little self-defense. I can't keep anybody in this room from putting their hand on me. But I can make you reevaluate choosing to do it again. Okay, when you take the cast off, you get to think, "Okay, I think I'll put my hand on him again." Well, you know, and it's not about being punitive or being harmful. It's just, why should I spend my life making you do something you're supposed to do? We told our daughter, "Hey, we're tired of fussing about grades. They're your grades. Your grades are connected to your curfew. A average is 11 o'clock, B average is 10 o'clock, C average is 9 o'clock. Anything below a C, you don't have a curfew because you ain't going nowhere. So you kind of decide what you want to do." And she was in charge of her grades and her curfew at the same time. I've even done strategies where when you come home from school, every minute you spend preparing for tomorrow is 2 minutes you get on the four-wheeler at the computer with the iPad or whatever. If you come in and say, I don't have anything to do for tomorrow, well, then you don't have any access to any of the things you like to do, but I have some jobs for you. These are called dandelions. They must all disappear from the yard before dark. Here's a pile of gravel, and for this reason, I want it moved from here to here with a spoon. You'd be surprised how many kids come and say, Dad, I don't have any homework, but I'm going to read an hour. I brought my social studies book home. And you'd be surprised that when you make them sit. Now, you got to be careful when you contract with kids. The first semester, we told Lonnie Beth, hey, your grades and your curfew are the same. She came home and proudly announced, Dad, I've signed up for conditioning PE and welding. That was her core curriculum subject. She had to buy a pair of pink Carhartts so she could weld. Okay, we're going to modify our contract that biology and history and math influences your curfew, not conditioning PE and welding. Okay, so you got to make sure you get that right. But really, you make the situation become their problem, not yours. Dad, I'll miss football practice if I can't drive. Not my problem. Should have behaved wisely with your car. And when my behavior costs me more than it costs you, I'll reevaluate or change my behavior. Attention deficit disorder kids require a little more creativity. With attention deficit disorder, you have neurobiofeedback, dietary changes, and stimulant medication that helps correct that behavior. All three of those things have one common factor in efficacy, and that is the consistency of their parenting, which tells me that a lot of the ADD, ADHD spectrum type stuff really comes down to inconsistency in parenting. Discipline must be immediate, severe, and consistent. If it's not immediate, severe, and consistent, it's probably not going to work. Now, it sounds like I'm doing this when I say, pay me now, pay me later. There's an immediate hurt when the child wants to go somewhere and they can't because they're reminded to clean their room. The consequence is the immediacy when it costs them something. You know, you tell a kid he's grounded and he's not going anywhere, big deal. But when he has to not get something that he wants to do because he's got to go back and redo something he didn't do, that has an immediacy effect that's different. Does that clear that up? I'm not talking two different languages there? Any general questions about discipline? I've looked at my clock and we're out of time. Any questions about either crisis intervention or discipline that maybe comes to your mind immediately? Raising Emotionally Intelligent Children by John Gottman. Anything by John Roseman, Ending the Homework Hassle, is a good text for dealing with kiddos. And then if you've got a really out-of-bounds type behavior, maybe kids with attachment disorder or maybe even an oppositional defiant, a Scott Sells book, S-E-L-L-S, Parenting the Out-of-Control Teenager, is a really good intervention tool. And just in general terms, Fred Jones's book, Positive Classroom Discipline. It's a big book. You won't enjoy reading it, but it's got some gold inside of it that talks about responsibility training for your children, and not only responsibility training, but how you can use body language to kind of help kids behave. If you notice, a lot of times when we deal with children, we don't use proper body language. In a school setting, a teacher's writing on the board and turns around. What's your name? Lisa's going to misbehave in my class. So Lisa's sitting there, and I'm writing on the board. I say, Lisa, you need to straighten up. Well, Lisa has not been affected or fazed by that. But if I stop writing on the board and I square off with Lisa, just like shooting a machine gun, and I make eye contact with her, and I don't smile, and I go, Lisa. Now, Lisa has just licked her lips because her mouth is now dry, and she's smiling at me because smiling is a sign of submission among primates, and she wants to be friends. I don't want to be friends. I want you to do what you're supposed to do. I don't have to say those words. I make eye contact with her and call her name. Time equals commitment. I'll sit here till it happens. Calm equals control. I'm not going to yell and scream and pitch a fit. So Lisa's still uncomfortable. She's, what can I do to get this guy to hush? And proximity equals intensity. How uncomfortable are you on a scale of 1 to 10? That's just like, it's no big deal, you know, so I don't care. But you can read the body language. She's rocking side to side now, and she's tilted her head, and she's looking at her husband, punch this guy, and all of a sudden, and if she really knew something she could do to make me move, she'd do it. She's not misbehaving, and she's still uncomfortable. When you talk to your kids, and you're assertive, and you're calm, and you just, Susie, you'd be surprised what'll happen. In a public school setting with emotionally conflicted kids, this system works. In the school system, you even get to the point where you put your hands on the desk or you go down to your elbows. And I think the world record champion at my wife's school is 5 minutes, but he will eventually comply. And, you know, learning to be a good parent is about using their energy, not yours, to be a good parent. It's not about being boisterous and loud and intimidating and then screaming and yelling. But calm equals control, time equals commitment, and then proximity equals intensity sometimes. And it usually works pretty well with your kids. Your kids know when you mean business, and your kids know when they don't mean business. You know, that's my biggest struggle in life, is not throwing business cards over the aisle at Walmart. Now, Johnny, I'm going to count to four. One, two, three. Johnny, Mommy's going to count to four again. I just want to throw a handful of business cards over the aisle. Beat the truck! But my wife drags me out of the store, and I'm not allowed to do that. But, you know, if you just one time that, you know, if you misbehave in public, you get it in public. If you throw a fit at the mall, you leave the mall. If you throw a fit at the party, you leave the party. If you sass me at grandma's, we leave grandma's. Your behavior costs you more than it costs me. You'll change your behavior. Any questions, comments, anything? Well, thank you very much for coming. I hate that I kept you over as long as I did. And we've got, what's next on the agenda? We get to eat. Hallelujah. Oh, good deal.